I'm Abby.
And I'm Allie.
And it's
About Time for True Crime.
Hi.
Hey, you guys.
How are you?
Happy day.
Happy drop day, pod day, listen day, why day, whatever day. Your day. My day. Hey, hey.
Correct. It's been a while since we've asked this, but what are you doing? Are you getting ready? Are you like me? Are you listening to something fucking horrible while you put your makeup on?
Or are you like me and driving 25-8 and tapping the little wheel like, I've listened to this pop song 80 fucking times. I'm going to lose my mind if I don't hear some true crime.
Yeah. Or are you one of those people that can listen to it in the shower and it doesn't freak you out?
Oh, can't do that.
I have tried. Not my strong suit.
No. I also cannot listen to it when I am alone at night.
That's a rule for me. I can't do it either.
I did for a hot minute listen to it while I was hiking, and then that started to spook me, I had to stop.
No.
I know, and I'm not like unsafe. Like, everybody knows where I am when I go hiking.
It's true. I'm always in the know.
But I am usually alone, and so typically I'm like
over every little thing. Yeah.
Once I saw it, so there's this path I like to go on that's sort of near someone's house. Like, it's its own separate public park, but somebody lives right next to that lot. And they were like biking around, and I was like pooping my pants because I was like, I see you here all the time. Oh my God. And finally one day he stopped me and he was like, hey, I see you all the time. Like, it's good to meet you. You know, my family lives here or whatever. And I was like, oh, thank God.
Like, yeah.
I was like, you have a family, a wife, children?
Okay, good.
Okay, all right.
You're more statistically likely to kill them than me. This is
right.
Great.
All right. Yeah, you don't know me that well. I haven't pissed you off yet, so.
Fucking horrible.
Promise I won't crop dust you. Bye. Like,
bet.
No, I wouldn't.
Abby had her fingers crossed. She was lying, you guys. Or do you listen when you're cleaning? I'm that.
Oh, yes. I like that,
listen
too.
If I've got a long drive, fucking take my bitches with me. We got to listen. If I'm getting ready, got to hear what's going on. And if I'm cleaning, I'm like, okay, well, I'm not the only one cleaning here.
Yeah.
It's me and my friends
doing physical
and we got
labor.
Some work to do.
Like, we painted your house to true crime.
We certainly did.
Yeah.
We really did. When I moved in here, it was not music. It was true crime podcast. And you know what? We got the job done. And when I'm cleaning my house around here, like alone, listening to my tunes, it's like every group project I've ever been in.
Mm-hmm.
I will do all the work. I'll know it'll be done right. And hey, we were all there.
I'll get a giggle along the way.
There you go.
So. But I am itching to tell you guys today's case.
I am.
So it's not that I'm not interested in what you're doing. I'm so interested in what you're doing. But
tell
also,
us and also listen.
I feel like you're interested in what I'm about to be doing.
Yeah.
And I'm really interested in telling you. So
can we tell them?
Yeah, if you want.
Okay. So, hey, you guys clicked on this and you know. So I'm taking the tiniest little smidge of credit here.
Yeah. Oh, please do.
Because
this is because of you.
I have always known this case, and you guys clicked it, so you know. We'll say we're covering Diane Downs.
Diane.
And this has been like on the list where I was like initially like, I'm gonna cover this. And then as we've done this for 120 some odd episodes, can you
Holy
guys
poop.
Believe it? I'm like, Abby needs to bring her psych lens to this case because there is so fucking much to unpack.
Oh, and we
so,
unpack.
Here we are, and she did the damn thing, and I fucking love an Abby hyperfixation.
It was a lot. We have, I mean, it's going to be two parts, so I'll let you all know that.
Heckers, yeah.
But in totality, we have 22 pages of Diane Downs research and psych to get into. So I have all the time in the world. I assume you don't want the world's longest intro and then a two-parter.
No, hurry up
and
tell
me. That is nitty-gritty. So, hi. Hello. Howdy, all you pod party people.
Heck yeah.
Welcome or welcome back to your favorite true crime podcast. Aw.
You
about
guys.
About time for true crime.
You shouldn't have.
You guys really shouldn't have. But now that you did,
aw.
Adorable. Today, I have a very special part one episode of what should be just a two-part series, so I'm going to jump in stat. Right off the top, a short summary of my sources. I used, and dare I say, loved, Love, Marry, Kill, a podcast that did another two-parters on this case, as well as Peacock's World Most Evil Killers episode on the case. I also used 2020 and Oprah. I used Oregon Live. I used All That's Interesting, ABC News, and more. but they're all going to be linked in the Google Doc that's linked below, because there are certainly too many sources to put down there and stay within our character limit.
Exactly. Can we just say real quick, a big shout out to Love, Marry, Kill, oh, Tina yeah. and Rich. I love them. I've been listening to them forever.
Their research is just so well done, and I trust that it's good research, which is hard for me to say with a lot of true crime podcasts that I enjoy a lot, to be like, okay, no, no, no. I know that this is right, and I know where I can find where they found it.
And I just want to have like a juice box and listen to them tell me stories.
I swear to God, I want a snack so bad. Every time I listen to that damn podcast, I'm like, where's my lemon square?
I want snacks. I know. I love them. And she's just like, she gets such a sweet, happy voice. And I'm like, yeah. Oh, just tell me everything. Read me my bedtime stories. Anyway, please. So shout out to them. Love them.
So love that. But I also wanted to give my little trigger warnings.
Oh, yeah.
There is violence against women and children, murder, offenders with cluster B personality disorders, and a lot of child abuse, like a lot of child abuse. So please take care of yourself. The ATFTC fam wouldn't be the same without you. And if you need to skip this, skip this. Okay. So.
You just sounded like Miss Fowl.
Okay.
Okay. Anyway. Anyone else watch Jimmy Neutron? All right.
And remember, have fun with it.
Okay, Jimbo.
Today, before I jump all the way in, I wanted to welcome you to Criminology 401. And by that, I mean a very brief summary of one article that I read for one class in my master's degree, which I think is actually pretty relevant here. Because for those of you who are interested in history, the Wild West, Alaska, or Taylor Swift's Gold Rush, you might be familiar with the concept of a frontier. A frontier being defined by Google's definition as the extreme limit of settled land beyond which lies wilderness. And when you think of this, you probably think of the Wild West and all of those John Wayne movies your grandfather made you watch every time you were there as a kid, even though you hated them every four times. Just me.
Or your dad, too.
Yeah.
Hi, Dad.
Or maybe you think of Alaskan Wilderness and Christopher McCandless and that school bus that he died in and Into the Wild.
Yep.
However, when it comes to criminology, or, you know, the study of crime and sociology, blah, 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 we use the word frontier to discuss something different. At least in this article, it was argued that the last frontier was not Alaska. It was not all of the uninhabited land and all of the countries that we've never been to, but it was nighttime. And they describe a lot about the similarities between nighttime as a frontier and all of these unsettled places and the people that are drawn to that. Maybe somebody wants a new life. A blank slate. Maybe somebody wants to just be fucking alone. Maybe they have a secret. Maybe it's fine, but maybe it's not. And perhaps someone wants less business, less people, less availability. And again, these things can all be great. Sometimes health related, sometimes mental health related. But for some, without doubt, in this situation, it can be used as an opportunity to wreak havoc with the potential of a lot less witnesses and a lot less consequences. Part of why I bring this up is because I've been someone who worked third shift, not out of desire, it was certainly necessity, and the ever-changing requirements of working in a field that helps maintain incarcerated people is like, you know, you need 24/7 supervision. It's not just like that cute 8-to-5. So
yeah,
I've done my time there, and I'll say there are a lot of people that work third shift out of necessity. Maybe it's the only shift open. Maybe they do rotations. But I've worked with a few people that asked to do third shift specifically. And for some people, this works. I'm not one of those people. My REM cycle was so pissed. It was so sick of my shit. But typically, in my experience, the people I found that like to work third shift are fascinating people. Usually a little awkward. Maybe anxious or just don't really like other people. And so they don't really want to interact with you, which is part of the appeal, I think, of third shift for that kind of person.
Yeah.
But I will say they have always had the very best TV and movie recommendations.
I believe that.
Yeah.
100%.
So good. I mean, part of the appeal for me of third shift was like, oh, you mean I do my rounds every hour, I make sure everything's clean and safe, and then I can watch Parks and Rec all night? Okay.
I mean, it's kind of hard to argue with that.
Right? Well, my sleep was pissed. But anyway, I want you to keep this in your mind because I think there's a lot that can happen at night for a lot of different reasons. But please, buckle up. Keep your hands, feet, arms, and legs inside the pot at all times because it's about to be a bumpy fucking ride.
Yeah, this one hurts.
Today, we're zooming into the night of May 19th, 1983 in Springfield, Oregon. Springfield, Oregon is an industrial town. Relevant geographical information includes that they are primarily working class and industrial town next to a much more affluent and at the time booming Eugene, Oregon. It might still be. I don't know.
Okay.
I didn't
and
look
the year in, again?
1983. Also culturally relevant, Ronald Reagan was the president of the United States of America at the time. A gallon of gas was 93 cents. Cartoons like Charlie Brown and Inspector Gadget were rising in popularity, as was Star Wars Return of the Jedi, which grossed over $250 million, more than $700 million in today's money, thanks inflation. Also, Michael Jackson's Thriller album was still booming from its release in 1982, but also on everyone's radio was Every Breath You Take by The Police, Hungry Like the Wolf by Duran Duran, and Down Under from Men at Work. Also, Atari and CD players were inching their way onto the market. There were huge perms, light wash jeans, club scenes, and bright parachute pants and colors everywhere. It was truly a time to be alive, bursting with innovation, new technology, and excitement, but still in a very large world before the internet made everything feel so small. So on May 19th, 1983, this is the world we're zooming into when we enter the Mackenzie Williamette Hospital in Springfield, Oregon. It's technically second shift, but late into the night, and certainly a lull for the ER shift.
Mm-hmm.
In the hospital, Dr. John Mackey was the physician in charge with two ER nurses, Rose Martin and Shelby Day, and a lone receptionist, Judy Patterson, who were shaking their heads to stay awake from a slow, molasses-moving shift. At 10:30 or 10:45 p.m., roughly, Dr. Mackey told Judy that she could go home. She was the receptionist. He was like, listen, we got what, like an hour left of the shift, an hour and a half. I'm pretty sure we got it covered.
I think we can handle it. Why don't you go on and get home?
Right, exactly. So she stops the reports she's typing up on her little typewriter, puts them away, and she packs up her stuff and she heads out. So as Judy packed up and started to leave, she happened to walk out the door at the same time as a small sedan, red Nissan, pulled up into the drop-off lane, honking the horn repeatedly, when a woman with light blonde hair and a slender face popped out of the driver's seat screaming, "Someone shot my kids. Help. Someone shot my kids."
What a terrifying thing to, like, when you leave for work, like, you leave the office, you are mentally...
Mm-hmm. You're doing
You try, and not every job, certainly in the criminal justice field, you oftentimes do not have the luxury of leaving it all there. And I have no doubt that the medical field is the same.
Yeah.
That you see some things, you deal with some shit, and your mind is still racing as you leave. But at least once you get to your car or you get on the bus or whatever it is that you're doing, it at least puts some physical distance between you and work. And you are just trying to get there mentally. And imagine, like, I'm done for the night. All right. Walking out and boom, someone shot my kids.
Crisis. Yeah. Yeah. And so Judy sees this and immediately runs back in. She tells the nurses and physician, who come out quickly. Judy did what she always did in emergencies like this, though. And when she had come back to tell, you know, Dr. Mackey and the nurses, she also called 911. Because if someone just shot her kids, she doesn't know if that person's following them to the hospital and they might be in danger. But also, clearly, there's a crime here.
There's been a crime. Correct.
Right. So they were on the way and she comes back out, where everybody is taking care of what's going on. So initially, the workers ran to the car to attend to the children. And there were three, who we know to be 8-year-old Christy Downs, 7-year-old Cheryl Ann Downs, and 3-year-old Danny Downs. And they were all clinging to life. Dr. Mackey and Nurse Martin and Nurse Day each took one of the three children and got to work. Christy, the oldest, was as close to dead as Dr. Mackey has said he's ever seen someone survive.
Wow.
She was said to be barely breathing upon arrival, as was 3-year-old Danny, who was found slumped over in the back seat.
3 years. I mean, how big is a 3-year-old? How much does a 3-year-old weigh? Like, that is such a tiny...
50 pounds max.
That's like diapers and pull-ups and little itty-bitty shoes.
Yep. Teeny tiny. Like, at max, starting toilet training, max. So... it didn't take long into the night for 7-year-old Cheryl to be pronounced dead, as her vitals were almost unrecognizable. Her heartbeat was so slow when they got there. I'm pretty sure it did not take long. I've heard varying reports that it was like almost as soon as they arrived up to like 3 a.m. So at max, she lived a few hours and was pronounced dead.
And they probably knew when they looked at her that...
Right. And I mean, of course, you know, I always think of Grey's Anatomy and it's like, why do we do all this stuff for someone we think is almost dead so we can look at their family and actually tell them we did everything we could? I imagine it's a case like that because you can't look at a 7-year-old and not do everything you possibly fucking can to try to save their life.
I cannot even... like, that stuff gives me chills, but it makes me so angry too that somebody could do that to a child.
Right.
And they are just the cutest, not that it matters, but they're the cutest fucking kids.
Right. Well, and Anne Rule wrote a book on this called Small Sacrifices.
Our girl Anne.
And the way she summarized the night was, one child was dead. One child had defied the odds and lived through profound blood loss, heart stoppage, and delicate surgery. And one child seemed stable, but was at risk of paralysis. Who, in the name of God, could have aimed a pistol at 3 small children and pulled the trigger? While the children had been rushed into surgery and the medical professionals were hard at work, Judy took care of the mother. We find her name to be Diane Downs, a young woman in her 20s. Dan was a postal worker who, in all of the chaos of the arrival, seemed to have forgotten to mention she herself had been shot in the arm. Judy did her best to dress Diane's wounds, noting that while the children hadn't been able to be tended to, Diane was able to at least pay her wound some attention, wrapping it in a towel of sorts and maybe rinsing it with like a water bottle or something. But this is where we'll put a pin. Fear not, we'll return today. But we're going to start to talk a little more about Diane, since she seems kind of important in all of this. I mean, the series is named after her, so, you know. Diane was born Elizabeth Diane Fredrickson on August 7th, 1955, to Wesley and Willadine Fredrickson in Phoenix, Arizona. Willadine and Wesley, who we'll hereby call Wes, were married in April of 1954, a short year and change before Diane's arrival. Wes, Diane's dad, was a post office worker in Phoenix, and Diane was the oldest of, I believe, 5 siblings, like 5 kids.
That's so shocking to me because the oldest is usually, or at least stereotypically, the responsible caretaker.
Right.
You know, most maternal, if you will, like that. You're sort of assigned that, or right. You take that on when you've got younger siblings. So it's just.
Well, and especially in this time period, you know, it's typical for like kids to have to pitch in to help with the other kids because it's typical to have 5+ kids at this point in time.
Yeah.
I don't know about you. I only have 2 hands.
The village has to help raise the village.
Yeah, exactly. So her younger siblings, John, Catherine, James, and Paul all came after. And Wes and Willadine raised their kids in a strict Baptist bubble to try their best to raise a good family. Diane's father, by all accounts, was a passionate man. He was a veteran with deep roots in a very strict Baptist church. Diane would later say that he had a lot of power over her mother, and she resented his constant lectures, discipline, and conservatism that he led the house with. Diane stated that as a kid, she couldn't wear anything fashionable or makeup because of the strict and conservative values that her parents had. Because of this, Diane was bullied pretty badly as a kid. But it didn't seem like that was her only trouble, because Diane at one point accused her father of sexually abusing her for about a year as a child. Diane reported that it started about 12 and that Wes would take her on long rides and fondle her inappropriately or molest her, later stopping and pretending like it never happened, like a year later. But I am not going to get into a lot of this. There are other facts and details that have been released about that. But the reason I'm not going to is because her parents have always denied this claim, and Diane herself seemingly later recanted it. So I'd rather not drag her dad entirely through the mud if it's all made up mud.
Exactly. And these things really frustrate me, because everyone who lies about saying that, you take away from real people who have survived that or gone through that. Like, right. you don't get to take something that's horrific or the most traumatic event of somebody else that you heard about, and you say, I'm going to adopt that because this is going to work well for me.
Right. I want that feeling.
You don't get to do that.
Well, I don't think that this was true, but something definitely happened, because Diane, I believe this is confirmed, has reported self-harming at 13, and she was clinically depressed, which, no offense, I don't know a single 13-year-old who isn't, like, depressed, because you're 13 and everything sucks and you're in middle school and you have no control over your life and you're going through puberty and you want to be an individual, but actually you're still very dependent on your parents, whose values you're, like, questioning, because you're like, is that me? I don't know. You're trying to find your own identity, and also, like, again, you're 13. So,
yes,
that is not to take away from it. I feel for all 13-year-olds.
Ugh.
And I hope, and it sounds like she did get help with her, as we like to call in the profession, non-suicidal self-injurious behavior.
Mm.
The NSSIB. Also of note from Diane's childhood, though, was that she was seemingly very jealous of her father. Her mom, Willa Dean, was so, in Diane's perspective, so busy trying to be a good wife that she often neglected the emotional needs of her kids. Further, because Wes was the disciplinarian, as was very typical, I think, for like a cis hetero family of this kind, like that nuclear setup of like mom stays home, dad goes to work. I think
dad's
often
the hammer, mom's the caretaker.
Exactly. So I don't think that that was like anything out of the norm, you know?
Her neighbors probably grew up the same way.
Right. But whenever Wes would execute punishment, Willa Dean always went along with it. And, you know, I, again, also think that's very signifying of the times. But also, she might have just agreed with it.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think is interesting to note, because she very clearly has some sort of resentment towards her father and the attention it took from her that everyone else gave him, you know? Further, she does later claim that she has no memories of her siblings as children, but does remember she wasn't allowed to punish them, which, like, good, you're also a child. But her parents would reportedly call her a tattletale, or she would get in trouble herself if she told them what her siblings were doing, if it was, like, wrong or bad.
So she's a fucking rat, huh?
Yeah. We didn't raise no rat, Diane.
Now you're punished.
She wrote this in a letter that we'll get into later, but that's how we know about it. So I just think it's very interesting to sort of look at this all together, because there's definitely something between her and her dad of resentment. And it doesn't sound like she has the same resentment towards her mom, which we'll talk about her mental health stuff later. But that to me feels like it would be more consistent with everything she has going on, of just being jealous of anyone who took the attention off of her.
Yeah, and who probably came in and immediately had the respect of the people in the room, right, that she probably wanted. And I mean, every relationship she had, she was manipulative to no end.
Yes.
Was this the man she couldn't manipulate because he was actually the one in power?
Quite
Is that
possible.
Her hatred of him? You know what I mean?
Yeah. And so I think, personally, I think it's probably a mix of that, but it's just a very interesting note, because I don't feel like you often see a lot of jealousy resentment from like daughter to father.
No,
you know, so just interesting. And Diane's childhood, while ideally not molested by her father, wasn't really great outside of the home either, because of the strict rules and the culture she couldn't partake in. Diane got bullied a lot, and so she never really fit in anywhere. But once she became a teen, like most teenagers, she had that brush with rebellion and angst. So when Diane was 14, she ended up going to a charm high school called Moon Valley High School in Phoenix. I don't exactly know what a charm high school is, but it was specified that it was that. So
okay.
Maybe it's like for witchcraft and wizardry, who knows? But this is where she met Steve Downs, her soon-to-be husband.
Mm.
Steve was an angsty, rebellious teenage girl's dream. He was a bad boy. He allegedly never had a shirt on. He was the kind of man that would be mean to the world, but good to my girl.
Yep.
You know? The fact that Wes and Willadine didn't like Steve made him that much better. Now he sparkled and dad hates him. Great.
Mm-hmm. My hero.
So not only was he hot and a bad boy, he was everything she wanted and everything her parents hated, and she loved it. After graduation, Steve and Diane stayed together, despite going long distance initially. Steve had joined the Navy. Now that Diane had graduated, she was going to Pacific Coast Bible Baptist College. However, Diane got kicked out after her first year.
Kicked out of college?
Kicked out.
Okay.
For promiscuity.
Ooh.
Yes. Diane had more autonomy and could cut her hair and wear cute clothes and makeup. And boys were into it. They were like, hello. And Diane was like, hi.
Yes.
Allegedly, I am not going to say that it happened. But I have heard accounts that she was canoodling on an altar with another boy, which could perhaps be why she got kicked out.
I think in a very strict
Baptist Bible culture,
that and doing that like in a church or something is like one of the biggest slaps in the face you probably could do. I think in most religions,
probably
doing that within the walls of a place of worship is not.
Anyway.
It's probably seen as disgraceful.
So Diane goes home. Womp womp.
Yeah.
And she returned to Steve. I don't know if Steve knew any of this. I kind of think he did and didn't care. But they returned home. And her and Steve continued to date.
She can canoodle him, but she loves me.
Right. Yeah. She might be in your bed, but who's she coming home to?
Yeah, who has to listen to her problems?
The interesting thing about Steve and Diane's relationship was, as you might have imagined, the involvement of her father. Allegedly, at some point after Diane had returned, I believe she was still living at home, but she started working, and he would always make sure that she would come straight home afterwards. So Wes was like, when's your shift done? I want you home. And I assume that part of this is like, it's probably the 70s. And I don't know if you know this, but in the Pacific Northwest, there was like every major serial killer that you've heard of in the 70s.
Must have been a lot of lead paint out that way.
Oh, for sure. Also, it rains a lot, and that sounds depressing. So,
but also, I think that like if you're living under someone's roof, they'll probably want to have an idea of what time you're coming and going from their home. I mean, I can understand that if she's like 20.
Right.
I mean, sure, she's an adult, but
she's still a kid.
She's
a kid adult.
She's still very young.
Yes. And so, allegedly, at some point after Diane had returned, whether this was like working or from a date, she had gone back home with Steve and not back home. And Wes had come around with a rifle and basically told Steve that if he wanted to sleep with her, he's going to have to marry her. And that is the beautiful story of how Steve and Diane got engaged.
And they say romance is dead.
Truly. So on November 13th, 1973, Steve and Diane wed, making her a former Fredrickson, you, in her mind, and now a Downs. What a beautiful, stressful love story. Okay, that being said, this is perhaps my favorite story right after Diane and Steve got married. And this was like a month in, about. Mm-hmm. Okay. So Steve comes home. This is how I picture it. He comes home from work. He like shrugs off his little whatever. And he's like, listen, I know I said that we'd hang out this weekend, but I'm busy.
Mm.
And in my head, Diane's like, busy with what? What the hell?
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, well, you see, I have a date.
Ugh.
And she was like, what? And he was like, no, 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 no. I made it before we got married. I just feel bad canceling
it
now.
I'm a man of my word, damn it.
Are you kidding me? He still goes. She irons his fucking clothes.
For his date.
For his date.
She's like, gotta make sure my hubby looks good.
Right? And she's like, for this other bitch.
I can't let you leave with wrinkles.
What will that say about me?
Wow. So I'm getting married this fall.
Yep.
And the things I would do if the weekend after we were married, my husband looked to me and said, I hope you didn't make plans for us, honey, because I already got some. You're not invited. Her name is...
I made it before we were married.
Before we were married.
But I'm not going to cancel.
Because when I set my mind to something, I do it. And exactly. Isn't that why you married me? Because I'm a go-getter.
You didn't want to be rude?
What a slap in the face. What an awful...
Yeah. Yeah. But also, like... I'm guessing if Steve knew about Diane's extracurriculars at college...
Oh, no doubt.
...and was in the Navy himself, that there was probably, perhaps not a policy, but certainly an open door.
I mean... Yeah. What did he do when he got to his date? Did he still, like, pay for the bill? So she's like, so, like, how are you? How was your week? And right. He's like, well, I got married on Saturday.
Yep.
And
my wife's being a real bitch about ironing my clothes for this, by the way. Do they look good?
She picked it out, though. Do you like it? Does it bring out my eyes?
Now, listen, I did not read this anywhere, but I did hear in one of the many things that I watched that he, like, came home very late that night.
Oh, so, snap.
Listen, no shame in that game, but you are a married man, so maybe a little shame in that game.
I mean, if there's all parties are consenting, who am I to judge? But, right.
But
damn.
I don't think Diane was downs for that, you know?
Mm-mm.
Sorry, I didn't even know I needed a dad joke in this, but I did.
Yeah.
Anyway, Diane found a love for the idea of her own family, and Steve and Diane created a beautiful little family in their own right. Their first daughter, Christy Ann Downs, was born in 1974, shortly followed by Cheryl Downs in 1976. Diane states that being pregnant for the first time was the first time that she ever truly experienced true love. She said she knew what it was like suddenly to love someone or something in an unadulterated way. She loved being pregnant. It became something she considered to be a purpose in her life. She loved that it made a break in the monotonous day of being a housewife in this era, serving meals and potentially trying to enter a workforce that was ever-changing but barely open to women. And yet still so misogynistic. Diane loved the attention she got from being pregnant. Everyone's like, oh my God, it's so cute. You're glowing. When you're due? When's the baby coming? What's the baby look like? Do you have clothes? Do you have a nursery? Do you want a shower? Can we give you gifts? Can we give you compliments?
Was it the love for the child or was it the attention that being pregnant gave her?
Well, she did not say that she loved being a mom. She said she loved being pregnant.
Right, because you have this visible, like, trophy that you can walk around with that people will love and adore you and say all nice and good things to you about. Most likely.
Exactly. And it's exciting. You get this excitement and attention for being an expecting mother, you know? Like, suddenly this is something you're doing, which also gives you credit for a lot of things. Diane got pregnant again, but terminated her pregnancy with an abortion. Afterwards, though, she had gone to, like, a fair where she passed an anti-abortion booth and regretted her decision. To make amends, she would later say, she wanted to get pregnant again. But here's the sitch, Melody Bostick. Steve was not a big kids guy, you know?
And she figured that out after...
And so after her third pregnancy that she had terminated, Steve got the old snip snip. You know, he had a vasectomy. He was like, I'm done. We have two beautiful, precious children. I barely like them. Let's just call it.
Yes.
But Diane was like... I want another kid. I want to be pregnant again. And I terminated that one. And I have to do this to cosmically even it out, I guess.
Diane's logic is something.
Diane, ever the slinky little minx, decided to seduce a friend of hers, which is how she got pregnant with their third child, Daniel Stephen Downs. In 1979.
She made his middle name her husband's name,
even
though it was someone else's baby.
I'm pretty sure she tried to play it off like, this is your child. And Steve was like, okay.
Really? Because it looks like Fred.
Right? Yeah. So she tried to play it off. But for Steve, that was the last straw.
So he knew when Danny was born.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm pretty sure he knew before that, because if he got a vasectomy...
I mean, it's not impossible. It's just not probable.
No, it's not impossible. But I'm pretty sure he was like...
He's like, that's just science.
Yeah, okay.
I don't know why I've made them like Southern.
I don't know. Well, they are from Arizona, but I don't really know the Arizona accent.
No, if there is one. And I don't think it's that, if there is one, but it's just... Yeah.
No, I get it. I think there's something about a relatively Southern state, knowing that they're like Baptist. I always get that Southern Baptist image in my head. Like, I hear you.
Yeah, but see, I love that accent, but I don't like them.
So good. No, I don't so like I, them, but I do like
it's
that
not
accent.
Really doesn't mix well to me.
Is it perhaps trying to soften the blow of how much you don't like them?
Maybe that's what it is.
Yeah, I'll
maybe
go with that.
Maybe subconsciously I'm like, I need some kind of redeeming quality.
I need something to hang on to here.
Correct.
I mean, besides, like, Steve and Diane had fought over alleged affairs before. I mean, they fought over finances, and later, Diane even said she knew she didn't marry Steve for love, but to escape her home. So it wasn't like...
Or it was just to get laid, because the dad was like...
pixie dust, you know?
But if the dad was like, well, you can either marry her and fuck her, or not and don't, he's like, well, shit.
Well, I don't know why Steve married her, but I know that she married him to get away.
Well, yeah.
According to her. Learning that Diane was pregnant and knowing that it was the definitive consequence of an affair after Steve had those pipes blocked, the two got divorced in 1980.
Yeah.
And this couldn't have been worse for Diane's mental health. She became increasingly negligent of her children, often leaving them unattended with her parents or with Steve. Her kids were seen underweight with poor hygiene and malnourished a lot.
And that was not a necessity. That wasn't because she quite literally was trying her best and couldn't provide. It was like everything she could provide, she just took for herself.
Exactly. And I mean, hell, Diane would leave the kids in the hands of Cheryl, her 6-year-old.
Yeah.
And she was watching, what, like a 4- or 5-year-old and a newborn?
I mean, the 6-year-old was probably a better caregiver than Diane, but that's not saying a whole lot.
Regretfully, yes.
I mean.
Diane often did this, though, to go find ways to fill her emotional needs by other men, whether it was sexual promiscuity or just the affection or admiration of a new stranger. Diane craved it. Needed it, even. And in 1981, Diane was working at the post office, slinky minxing her way around to another affair. And I literally named this section, is it an affair if you're divorced? Well, technically not for Diane, but the man was married, so I'm gonna say yeah.
Yep.
So it was in 1981 that Diane met and started sleeping with her coworker. And listen, I'm not going to lie to you and say I know his name. There have been more than a few aliases between Ann Rule's book, other reporters, and like things that have been talked about in court documents and all of that. In court documents, it's been hard to tell because from what I know, I'm going to use the full name Robert Knickenbacker.
Yeah, Knickenbacker.
Mm-hmm. And he went by Nick.
Nick Knickenbocker. When I first heard that, I almost fell out of my chair.
Nick, that in your bocker, you know?
It's like, just...
Yeah, so Nicky Nick over here.
It's like, he doesn't give a dimsdale dimadam.
No, but my name isn't Nick Knickenbocker. If I can't sleep with your ex-wife.
Correct. If I can't cheat on my wife with yours.
Well, and that's the name I'm going to use because I've seen it the most. So we'll call him Nick, but that is who we're referring to here. See, Diane has a lot of mental health that we'll get to soon, but part of which meant that she was an incredibly flirtatious woman. Even when she wasn't trying to sleep with you, you thought she was trying to sleep with you.
Hmm.
And if you asked, she'd probably say yes because of other mental health. Like,
yeah. So mental health issues.
So when Diane and Nick got going into this affair, he had presumed that from her reputation and the charisma she had, that it would just be like an easy fling. Like, we'll sleep together until we get bored and then it's done.
I mean, as casual as it could be, sure.
Right. And Diane was seemingly just looking for affection and attention.
Well, she's always looking for attention.
It wasn't so much the case that it was no strings attached, because Diane became clingy and attached, like nearly delusional at the thought of being with him. And something that's interesting to me, and not delusional in that like this was wildly out of the realm of possibility, they were fucking, so like obviously there's something there, you know?
Yeah, and I'm sure he talked one way to her,
right,
and another way about her.
But many of her diary entries that we see later are like addressed to him, like they're letters to him. It's not like, dear diary, today I did this. And it's not like, I just have to process what happened today. It was like, oh, my dearest Nick.
Interesting. Like she was expecting the diary to be found?
Almost. Or like she
is somehow therapeutic to like write the letter and never send it?
Yeah, I guess.
Okay.
Or maybe she just is like, I need this on paper and I'm obsessed with this man. And this is what I'd say to him if I could. I don't know. But it's very interesting. It's all like addressed as a letter.
There's a lot to speculate about with Diane.
Yes. But for Nick, I mean, he wanted something dumb and flingy and not like a marriage. He already had one of those. It wasn't going so hot.
It wasn't his favorite thing.
No, clearly.
And Diane was an attractive petite woman. I mean, yeah. And if she was flirting with you and pursuing you, she has a way about her of speaking.
Right. And I mean, she's very intelligent. We do know this. And fun fact, she believes that there are 8 levels of intelligence. And she says that she's on the 7th. I don't know what any of that means.
What is 1 through 7?
Fuck if I know. Apparently I'm on 2.
Apparently, yeah. I'm with you.
But it, you know, for Nick, yes, he wanted something dumb, but it wasn't long after that that it was replaced with an urge to come clean and make up with his wife either. But the two played games back and forth for a long time. Like,
he'd get back with his wife, she'd come back in, he'd entertain her for a bit, he'd go back with his wife,
right? He'd be like, well, I can't trust you to do this thing. And then she'd do the thing. And he'd be like, oh, great. Now I can leave my wife. Except we just made up. Like,
yes.
Yes. And Diane was like, well, I hate you. Unless you want to fuck again.
I know.
And so Diane remembered that this wasn't the life she wanted. Yes, she wanted the affection. Yes, she wanted the attention. But it wasn't Steve that made her feel love. It wasn't Nick that made her feel love. It was being pregnant that made her feel loved.
Which is odd, like she thought the fetus just adored her from there or something, or just the attention she got from everybody else was a really nice substitute for one person's care and attention.
Yes, and at 25, she was like, okay, so I've had my kids. I don't really want more kids. But I love being pregnant. I'm going to surrogate. Which is like a pretty sound, logical sequence of thoughts there for Diane, which I'm just going to take a minute to praise because we don't get that a whole lot. So hooray.
I mean,
but here's the thing.
How did the woman pass a psych eval for that?
Well, she didn't.
Oh.
And she didn't twice.
Cool.
And they still let her do it.
Wow.
Yeah. So she did eventually surrogate for another family, giving birth to a 4th child named Jennifer on May 8th, 1982.
Okay.
Come 1983, after another spout of the will they won't they on the Diane and Nick Knickerbocker show, Diane had put in for a transfer from her post office to one in Oregon. So she was going to move from Arizona to Oregon. And she was like, you know what? I'm done with you, Nick. I have to leave. I hate you. I never want to see you again.
So she's in Oregon going to go back to Arizona? Is that what you said?
No, she's in Arizona and going to go to Oregon.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
And Nick is like, okay. But he didn't think she was going to do it. Ew. And then they made up. And I think they did the do.
Mm.
And she was like, oh, I'm going to cancel it. But the post office was like, the fuck you are?
We already transferred your whole position. We've got you lined up there. Your job here has been filled.
Exactly.
Well.
And so she was devastated, but not that devastated. Because she was like, ugh, you know, life and its hills and its valleys. He'll follow me there.
Mm.
Well, spoiler alert, he did not fucking follow her there. He is a married man with clearly a lot of issues to work through in that marriage, but he stayed there.
Wasn't willing to divorce his wife for you before. He's probably not going to do that and move across the country for you.
Right. Well, and further, once again, how could I tell you in any other words? He did not want anything with strings attached. He wanted to fuck around on his wife and go home to his wife.
Mm-hmm.
Which, not my policy, but if it's theirs, so be it. He wasn't looking for that. And specifically, he did not want to be a dad.
Yeah, he made that pretty clear, right?
Incredibly clear. And now, in 1983, well, technically April of 1983, Diane was all alone, a single mother of three working at a post office in Springfield, Oregon.
With no family around her, right?
Correct. No friends. Fresh start. Her own kind of frontier, almost.
Sure.
But here's the thing. Is it an Abby deep dive if we don't end up in an armchair psychology corner? I think not. So we have quite a bit today.
Hells yeah.
Diane had been diagnosed with a few mental health conditions, and I think that it is appropriate to talk about them here. Because Diane doesn't just have a great personality. It's her disorder. Well, it's three of her disorders, actually.
Sprinkle of this, little of that.
I don't think you were all here to just hear about, like, her charm, you know? But I bring this up now because personality disorders don't often present until later in someone's life. Usually, like, mid to late 20s is when you start to see them rear their ugly fucking heads.
Which is the exact time frame we're talking about here.
Correct.
It wouldn't have presented earlier.
And I'm going to put in an asterisk here. If you know someone with a personality disorder, they're likely not going to murder their kids. Most mentally ill people do not hurt other people. A lot of people who hurt other people happen to also have mental health.
Correct.
But it is not a cause and effect of violence.
Exactly.
So I do want to bring it up because, again, this is the timeline that we're in. And the thing I like to remind people of is how diagnostics work. Because unlike the chickenpox or influenza, there's no minute clinic you can go to find out if you have schizophrenia. You know, they're not going to stick a little thing up your nose and be like, just as we thought, depression.
You tested positive for anxious.
Womp womp. You have bipolar. But wait. Oh, you came back negative for type 1? Type 2.
Yeah, no.
So,
although with AI, who knows, in a year, they're going to start saying they can do that.
Oh, dear God, just by looking through your phone. Every single Probably. Diagnosis in the DSM-5, or the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, 5th edition.
If you don't have one, it is, I think it's fun to read.
It is perhaps my favorite book, which is sad to say, but I think that might actually be true. But what psychologists and psychiatrists alike use to diagnose mental illness is the DSM-5. But there's a disclaimer at the end of every single fucking illness that you can be diagnosed with in there that reminds professionals that a diagnostic only sticks if the person's symptoms can't be better explained by something else, aren't the result of another drug or substance that is causing those symptoms, and this usually takes a long time to differentiate because there's a lot of disorders that are similar in symptomology and different in root cause.
Exactly.
So Diane had been diagnosed with a few, as we mentioned, and we're going to talk about those. From the sources I've seen, professionals have diagnosed Diane Downs with antisocial, histrionic, and narcissistic personality disorders, or what I like to call a cluster B cocktail.
Oh, no.
I mean, we'll talk a little bit about how personality disorders are clustered, but she has three out of the four possible cluster B personality disorders.
Yeah.
Which is phenomenal. What a batting average on her, you know? So before we get all the way into this, I want to remind you, or I just want to let you know how this is going to go. We're going to talk about the DSM-5 definition of these disorders. And then as we start to make our way back to the night of the hospital, I promise I will point out all of the connections in Diane and her symptoms, if you will. Antisocial personality disorder, we've talked about before on this podcast, certainly in depth with Ted Knees of Steel Bundy, But as a refresher, if you haven't heard that deep dive, here's what the Book of Mental Health Disorders says is a requirement for this.
Mm-hmm.
For someone to be diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder, they have to have the presence of a pervasive pattern of disregard and violation for the rights of others. This behavior begins by age 15 and is present in various contexts. Clinical features include having at least three of the following: failure to conform to social norms concerning lawful behaviors, such as performing acts that are grounds to arrest; deceitfulness, repeated lying, uses of aliases, or conning others for pleasure or personal profit. Personally, I would say check.
Mm-hmm.
Impulsivity or failure to plan. A check.
Mm-hmm.
Irritability and aggressiveness, often with fights or assaults. Maybe. Reckless disregard for safety of self or others.
Check.
Consistent irresponsibility. Failure to sustain consistent work behavior or honor monetary obligations. I would say the irresponsibility is there, at least in regards to the kids. And lack of remorse, indifference to or rationalizing having hurt, mistreated, or stolen from another person. The individual has to be 18, and there has to be evidence of these symptoms on or before age of 15. The occurrence of antisocial personality disorder is not exclusively during the course of schizophrenia or bipolar. So, like, mm-hmm. again, can't be explained by something else.
Right.
So, the next disorder I want to talk about would be narcissistic personality disorder, which, oddly enough, we also covered in the Ted Bundy series.
What a match they'd be.
Oh, God.
And they almost had the timing right.
Bonnie and Clyde.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my gosh. Not to bring Gypsy Rose into every fucking episode, but there was that Hulu, like, true crime series on it called The Act. And one of the credit songs was, like, this weird French version of Bonnie and Clyde. And that goes through my head every time I think about them now. But anyway. So we're going to talk about narcissistic personality disorder. And here is the criteria for that. In interpersonal settings, there is a pervasive pattern of grandiosity, need for admiration, and lack of empathy. This pattern of behaviors onsets in early adulthood and persists through various contexts.
Clinical
features mean you have to have at least five of the following: having a grandiose sense of self-importance, such as exaggerated achievements and talents, expecting to be recognized as superior even without commensurate achievements.
Yes.
Preoccupation with fantasies of success, power, beauty, and idealization.
Yes.
Belief in being quote-unquote special and that they can be only understood or associated with by other high-status people or institutions. Demanding excessive admiration, a sense of entitlement, exploitation behaviors, lack of empathy, envy towards others, or belief that others are envious of them.
Mm-hmm.
Arrogant, haughty behaviors and attitudes. And lastly, we're going to talk about histrionic personality disorder, which we'll talk quite a bit about, because personally, I think this is probably her, like, primary diagnostic and the others were accompanying, if
yeah,
you will.
But this one fits the best, do you think?
Right. Not even that, but I think this is the most visible in her personality and the way she interacts. And I think the other two sort of allow it to go as far as it did. So, like, I need this, I need this, I need this, but it doesn't matter because I'm narcissistic and I'm the best. And also, if you say that I'm not, well, fuck you. I have antisocial and I truly don't have any empathy and I do not care.
Right.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
So, for histrionic personality disorder, the DSM-5 says you need the following for a diagnostic. A pervasive pattern of excessive emotional behavior and attention seeking begins in early adulthood and is present in various contexts.
Mm-hmm.
Clinical features include at least five of the following: uncomfortable when others are the center of attention. Interactions with others are overly sexual, inappropriate, or provocative. Rapidly shifting and shallow emotions. Consistently utilizes physical appearance to draw attention. Impressionistic and vague speech that lacks details. An exaggerated expression of emotion that is theatrical and self-dramatized. easily influenced by others or circumstances, and considers relationships to be more intimate than they are. Which I think is pretty... That's like pretty Diane to me. I mean, what do I know?
It does seem that way. Although I think she's a good even mix, because I think the other two, or maybe at least narcissistic, is like, I'll take all of the praise, none of the blame.
Right.
And antisocial is like, and I really don't care what you think about it.
Yeah, it's almost like the narcissistic and the histrionic pair really well of like, I need to be the center of attention, but also I deserve to be the center of attention.
Like, I am entitled to this. How dare you not give that to me? Right. But I'm also going to behave in... like this pendulum like behavior while I am either so far one way or so far the other to get that attention. I need right. to be the center of attention.
And I don't care if I exploit you. I deserve this.
I do, but it was for a better cause, and that better cause is me.
Yes. You wouldn't understand. You're too stupid.
That's Diane in a nutshell.
So I think something worth keeping in mind here is that, again, all of these fall into a cluster B personality disorder.
Abby, what's a cluster B personality disorder?
So glad that you asked.
Thanks.
It's not impossible to have personality disorders are like cross clusters, if you will. Like, you could have a variety, but they are typically sort of categorized in specific issues that they cause. So I'm just going to do a little brief overview. You can have a personality disorder, and these are split up into clusters A, B, and C. Cluster A personality disorders are categorized by ailments that involve odd or eccentric personality types. Examples of these would be like paranoid or schizoid personality disorders. And these illnesses seem to have some sort of theme of like an individual being afraid to get intimate and close with someone else, so they come off as distant or cold. Then there's cluster B personality disorders, of which Diane Downs has three of the four possible diagnoses. Mm. And these are categorized as ailments involved with dramatic and eccentric personality types. So the only other one she could have gotten that she did not get was borderline personality disorder. And a lot of these have issues with like almost violating other people without recognizing that that's what's happening. Or if you do, not being able to care. Really. And this can come with like a variety of different settings. But like in histrionic, all of these deal with like sort of being the center of attention. And if it hurts other people, not really caring or not being able to care. Right. And that's, again, this is not like clinical. That is sort of a pervasive theme that I noticed. But the other cluster personality types is a cluster C personality disorder. And these are categorized by ailments involved with anxious and inhibited personality types. Examples of cluster C personality disorders are obsessive compulsive personality disorder, which is different than OCD, and avoidant and dependent personality disorders. Here, the prevailing theme that I saw was like a lack of self-confidence and severe sensitivity to rejection. So you have like a lot of anxious and fear-driven responses.
Mm-hmm.
So now that we got that out of the way, let's take our pin out of that hospital visit.
Oh.
Because if you remember, on May 19th, 1983, Judy, the receptionist who was supposed to leave and got lassoed right the fuck back in by Diane Downs.
She was so close.
She was interviewing and sitting with Diane while the doctor and the nurses were doing everything they could to save her three children's lives.
And I mean, she had an injury, but she was nowhere near critical.
No, she was shot in the left arm, but her wound was seemingly dressed. I mean, not a lot, but it was more than the kids, because the kids weren't at all, which is just odd. Like, I guess if it was me, I might be like, okay, you might need to drive, but like, I don't know how you get a towel in the car. Anyway, all that to say, Judy was helping Diane with her arm, and there were a few interesting pieces of information and answers that Diane gave that were noteworthy. First and foremost, the police had come. Obviously, Judy had called them and they were on the way. The first thing that Judy noticed was Diane's eyes lacked quote-unquote depth. And according to a forensic psychologist in Britain, she believes this to be due to the lack of empathy that comes along with the antisocial personality disorder. I'm sure you've heard of or like seen the cliche somewhere on Facebook in like weird fonts that say the eyes are the gate to the soul, you know, or like the window or the door or whatever, because I can fucking see your soul through your eyes.
Correct.
In all honesty, that's likely because our minuscule eye muscles change with varying emotions and what read to people a lot of our emotion in nonverbal communication. So like, if you see someone's eyes, you are more likely to get the emotion that they have based off of like an isolated clip of their eyes than you would be from like an isolated clip of their cheeks. You know?
Yeah. So if you could only see some like a picture of somebody's eyes, you could guess their emotion or reaction to something rather than if you were like looking at their mouth or.
Right.
Yep.
And part of this is just like facial makeup. Part of it is the way that you respond when people tell you news. But empathy is a really interesting psychological phenomenon because you're taking on this emotion of someone else and you sort of project it back to them. But in, I want to say like a muted way sometimes, not like you don't feel it, but just the way your facial expressions are, it's a lot less intense. Like if I'm helping my friend who's sobbing, I'm going to look sad, but I'm not going to be sobbing.
You it's know? Like a lesser version. It's a pacified mirroring.
Yes. And I'm going to try not to get incredibly off topic here because this was a heavy foundation to both of my theses for my degrees. But this usually includes mirror neurons. And mirror neurons are some of my favorite things to talk about in psychology, giving you the simmered down, put into a very small and few sentences, bite-sized portion of what these are.
Mm-hmm.
They are basically the neurons that you subconsciously have that help you fit into a different situation. And usually, like, I like to call them the Darwinism neurons in your brain because they literally help you survive.
Mm-hmm.
But this could be as little as, like, you are in an interview with someone that you want to impress. If you take a pause and look down at your posture, you are probably mirroring what they're doing. So, like, if their legs are crossed, your legs are probably crossed the same way. If their arms are crossed, your arms might be crossed, that kind of thing, where you don't even really think about it. It's not like, oh, okay, I got to do this now. It's like your brain just does that for you to help you adapt. And so what's interesting is empathy often does this in our eyes, right? We see it, we start to mirror it, and that makes them feel more comfortable. And usually that would be if our brain is like, we are safe, we can do this, this is an okay time. You know what I mean?
We're allowed to build rapport here.
Right. And so, okay, I'm just going to put a little asterisk in here. If you do have an interview, take a look. But like, if you're not mirroring them, it doesn't mean you're broken and you're also not like a psychopath. Just for a heads up.
Yeah, we're talking about these things focused on Diane. First of all, when we talk about these diagnostics too, because not everybody that has those things would hurt a fly or are bad people or whatsoever. We are specifically cross-referencing all of this with
this case.
Yes.
And I want to make that very clear because Diane is her own kind of something. And like a lot of people are diagnosed with many different things.
Yeah, but there's a reason we wanted to sit and spend two episodes on this is because she is a very specific, particular kind of person.
Yes. And the thing about a lot of this is like, our brains are so complex. It's just complex, like electrical unset jello up there deciding everything. So there are so many reasons that symptoms might look different. They might result in different behavior for different people. And, you know, you might not be crossing your legs the same way as your interviewer, but you might be. And it's kind of a fun experiment to check. But anyway, I'm moving on to the rest of that night because the lack of depth in her eyes was the first thing that caught Judy, the receptionist's attention.
Interesting.
Of the other interviews done that night, the police were included, and they had asked Diane what happened. Diane said she was visiting a friend with her kids in the small family of four. Diane and her three children, Christy, Cheryl, and Danny, were driving home like around 10 p.m. on a back road. They took the scenic route, if you will, just sort of taking their time. And Diane said at this point that she was driving when she saw a bushy-haired stranger standing in the middle of the road, flagging her down, like waving his arms and such. And she decided to stop and get out and talk to him. She said that the first thing he said was for her to give her the car keys, and she had made some smart-ass remark like, oh, you've got to be kidding me.
I doubt all of that very much.
Which she reported created a conflict, an altercation that left her shot in her left arm. She also reported that this bushy-haired stranger then went to the driver's side of the car, either through the window or opened the door, shot all three of her children in the back seat. And then Diane says that her memory is pretty spotty during this, but somewhere in the midst of getting back to reality after the trauma and the pain of the gunshot to her arm, Diane says she fake threw her car keys into the abyss and the bushy hair stranger chased after them like it was a game of fetch, and she hopped in the car and drove away. Sped off to the hospital. And well, now here she is.
Okay.
So the police take this story, albeit with a grain of salt or a few pounds, but they set off to see what they could see. Mm-hmm. And also they had to tell the public what was happening, because if in fact there was a bushy-haired stranger with a gun ready and willing to kill a 3, 7, and 8-year-old for a car that he did not even obtain.
Yep.
Well, people should probably know that.
Might be important in this, what did you say, very small town?
Yeah,
outside of this rich area. So it's like a bunch of businesses, there's a lot of like hardworking people,
it's a lot of industrial workers, so like I'm sure there's plenty of large warehouses and dark parking lots.
That's
like,
what I mean.
I like, would want to know.
There's yeah. places you, it's not this billowing farmland where there's like 10 people and you just have to let them know. It's like there's so many places for you to hide.
Right. But Diane wasn't done at the hospital, not by a long shot. After calling Nick about what happened.
Nick Knickenbocker.
Nick Knickenbocker, indeed.
Who doesn't give a Dimmesdale dim-a-dam?
He does not give a Dimmesdale dim-a-dam. He is not yo daddy, and mm-mm. he is not those kids' daddy. But Diane spoke with the doctors and nurses about her kids. I believe she already knew that Cheryl, her 7-year-old daughter, was pronounced dead. But again, if it was as late as 3 a.m., there's a chance that she wasn't aware at this point. But first, Dr. James Mackey, the physician in charge that we spoke about, said Diane was calm, self-assured, and seemingly in control. She would laugh or even giggle at times. And this was, of course, surprising. But also atypical for a woman who just found out that one of her children is dead, based off an attack that was unprovoked by a bushy-haired stranger in the middle of the street. But Dr. Mackey still had to explain what was going on. I mean, that's his job. But he told Diane about Danny, her 3-year-old. He had been shot in the spine, and at 3 years old, Danny would be a paraplegic for the rest of his life.
Mm.
Or at least they assumed. They were pretty sure. But Diane did not believe that, which is very interesting. She did later say, like a few years later, went on Oprah and said she believed he would walk again. But she actually said something along the lines of, oh, it didn't hit him in the heart.
What?
Like she had been surprised by that fact.
Dare I say disappointed?
Perhaps.
Maybe she thought that was good news. Maybe she's Perhaps. Like, well, that'd be great if it's not the heart.
But that was tiny compared to what happened with Christy. Because while all of this is concerning and it's, you know, red flags, more fun. But it's nothing more at this point than tearing apart a woman who was seemingly in an incredible amount of traumatic stress and shock and had been assaulted and watched her kids get shot and ran off to the hospital. And, you know, we talk a lot on this podcast about not judging how someone grieves.
Exactly.
But when Diane got told about Christy's injury, which included the inability to talk due to a stroke she had suffered.
Oh, my God.
She told the doctors pretty immediately that, well, if she was going to have brain damage, you should just let her die.
What?
And hear me out. It's a terrible choice to have to make for someone if, you know, you are alive and you have to decide what medical procedures to be done. But it is almost never the first thing that comes out of someone's mouth when they hear about an injury.
It's usually the thing that they fight, say, don't tell me to do that. Here, give me 10 other things we can try first. What are the things
that we can do?
Yes.
And Diane, well, I think the hard part for me was that Diane was given no indication that she had to make that choice at this point. But also, she had just lost another child.
How could she fathom losing another?
How do you so quickly say, well, you know, if her brain's going to be a little weird, just let her die.
Did you ever watch Talladega Nights? Little levity here.
Yes.
Okay. Do you know when he's in the hospital bed and she's like, I have never seen him make that noise before. I want to pull the plug.
Yeah.
And the doctor's like, he's yawning.
Yes.
She's like, I don't want to do it. She's like, yep. I'm sorry, Ricky.
It's so scary.
Mama loves you. Come here. And it's literally, like, it's that kind of idea where it was like, obviously, that's just a little bit of levity here. But that, right. Of course, things were bad, but that was not on the chopping block to discuss. It wasn't like, we're going to pull the plug. It's, we are doing everything that we can. We are fighting for your daughter.
Right. And she's like, well, if she's going to have brain damage, just let her die.
And she's like, just don't bother.
And I think what's hard for me is like, there was not even a, well, what does brain damage mean? How does this apply in real life? What are right. we looking at?
Like, what's her quality of life? What, are, you know?
I mean, even if that's where your brain is going, there are none of those concerns or questions mm-hmm. to sort of accurately assess what's happening. And concerning, yes, absolutely. But the fact that she was still calm, it wasn't like, oh my God. It was just like, okay, well.
She's then like, just, so do what you got to do then.
Do it or don't. And absolutely concerning. I'd even go as far as to say that this is a blaring, light up, blinking, red flashing sign for neglect and maltreatment of your kids.
I'd agree.
But more so was Christy's response, because Christy couldn't talk. She was hooked up to every machine and had been shot at point blank range, barely clinging to life, after certainly the most traumatic experience of her short 8 years.
Oh, poor baby.
But what threw a billion red flags up to the doctors afterwards was what happened when Diane would go into her room. Because when Diane went into her room, every time she entered and started talking, Christy's heart rate monitor would beep because her heart rate would skyrocket. Even when Diane would say things like, Christy, I love you, her blood pressure would just spike.
Because she was absolutely terrified and she had no way she could get away. Like, they just saw terror in her eyes, basically.
Probably. But I think at this point, I mean, she was probably still sleeping from all of, like, the surgery. So just laying there, her body, like, was terrified.
Was responding to yes. that presence.
But Diane was eventually allowed to go home. Christy and Danny sat recovering, unable to speak, and traumatized in the Mackenzie Williamette Hospital in Springfield, Oregon. And that, my friends, is where I will leave you.
Part one. Fuck you.
I'm sorry.
Ugh.
It's a hell of a case.
No, it is. That's...
And next week isn't going to be, like, a lot better. This is definitely, like, the hardest visual of all of it, but it gets harder to stomach later.
And Cheryl's the one that died.
Yes.
Cheryl, she was 7?
Cheryl Ann Downs at age 7 died on May 19th, 1983.
What is that? First grade? Second grade? 7 yeah. years old. Wow.
And she hadn't even hit double digits.
That is so sad.
Probably never had a school dance. Which, honestly, kind of good for her. Those are the worst.
I'm going to cry.
But it is a fucking miracle that Christy Downs lived and Danny Downs. I mean, truly. But Christy was like...
The one that they said if anyone was going to...
Yeah. That doorstep to death. I mean, she was on it. She was knocking. Someone grabbed her by the freaking waist and was like, no, you don't.
What a,
like,
resilient little kid.
Oh, you have no idea. We're going to get into more of it next episode. But Christy is my freaking role model. Like, she is a hero. This kid.
Wow. Well, stay tuned for next week's episode. And if you liked what you heard and you want to hear more of it, don't forget to download.
Rate.
Review. Follow.
Oh my God, if you guys could leave a review on, like, Apple Podcasts or Spotify, that would make my whole life. I keep refreshing it and I'm like, please tell me.
Yeah, make Abby's day, you guys.
Tell me what you think.
Yeah.
If you are on Spotify, you can scroll below and see
where it says, what do you think about this episode?
Yes, there's always a Q&A of, like, what did you think? Sometimes we will have, like, polls that you can answer a question that we have for you. So. I love that. I think the interaction is awesome. It always is encouraging to keep going. But also, if you wanted to see the people, the places, the things that we're talking about today, you could definitely do that. But you would have to do that at our Instagram, which you'd find if you typed up at About Time for True Crime Pod with periods in between every word. So that is ABOUT period, TIME period, FOR period, TRUE period, CRIME period, POD because podcast was too long. But if you, much like our Instagram name, wanted to be a little bit long, not so brief, wanted to tell us what you think, I don't know, your medical expertise, who knows?
Or send your pod pets.
Oh, please send your pod pets. They're so cute.
I know. You could send that to our email. And if you wanted to do that, you would email us at abouttime4tc@gmail.com. So that's ABOUTTIME4TC@gmail.com.
So I am so excited for part two, you guys. But we will have to see you next week. Because if I look at my clock, that was
About Time for True Crime.
Bye.
Bye.